Chapter 77. War Crimes. The subject of war and war crimes takes us straight to the heart of the mystery that baffles every criminologist. Why is man, alone of all creatures, the only one who systematically murders his own kind? For nearly 2,000 years, Western man has accepted the answer given by the Christian Church. Man is a fallen creature, and one result of the fall was the murder of Abel by his brother Cain. But in recent years, zoologists and students of animal behaviour have suggested an altogether more revolutionary theory, that man achieved his present position as the world's most dominant species because he is the descendant of a killer ape. Killing, according to this theory, is so much a part of man's basic personality that he'll never be able to throw off the habit. The gloomy conclusion seems to be that civilization will never tame man. In fact, the more highly evolved it becomes, the more man's basic aggression will struggle to burst out. Looking at the increase in the crime figures, this seems horribly plausible. A mere century ago, America was still a great wilderness. But although there was plenty of casual violence, shootings and stabbings in the course of quarrels, there was very little premeditated murder. This is the reason for premeditated murder arousing such widespread fascination and horror. Cases like Professor Webster's murder of Dr. Parkman, or England's famous Red Barn murder. Now, it sometimes looks as if murderers have entered into a kind of competition to see who can commit the most gruesome and sadistic crime. Heath, Haig and Christie seemed shocking enough in the 50s. Speck, Manson and Ian Brady horrified the 60s. But in the 70s, 80s and 90s, the pageant of sadistic mass murder, Dean Call, the McCrary family, Herb Mullin, Gerald Schaffer, Edmund Kemper, Fred and Rosemary West, threatened to hammer our responses into a state of insensibility. It begins to look very much as if man is protesting against the civilization that's trying to force him to forget his animal past. Each time the hidden monster breaks out, he seems more bloodthirsty than ever. But before we accept this depressing conclusion, let's take a careful look at how it was reached. As recently as 200 years ago, it was a basic article of Christian faith that man had been created by God in his own image, and looked exactly as he does today. Then geologists began digging up ancient bones and fossils that cast doubt on this theory. Some of these primitive bones and skulls were obviously the remains of some kind of human being. Scientists found a simple way to get round this problem. They agreed that these creatures were some form of human being, but they were not the ancestor of modern man. No, the world had been through a series of great catastrophes, like the flood, which had wiped out all life, whereupon nature had started all over again. So modern man was made specially by God after all. In 1859, the whole world was rocked by the publication of a book, The Origin of Species, by Charles Darwin, which proved, with data, that modern man had evolved from these primitive ape-like creatures. The church roared with rage and declared that it was blasphemy to assert that man had descended from an ape. And until recently, there were still schools in America's Deep South where it was illegal to teach the theory of evolution. But worse was to come. According to the theories accepted in the first half of this century, Homo sapiens had evolved because of his intelligence. He started as a gentle vegetarian creature, like his brother the ape, slowly learned such skills as hunting and agriculture, and so created civilization. However, in the late 1920s, scientists found an even more primitive form of man at Chao Kaotien in China, and there were unmistakable signs of mass cannibalism. They found piles of skulls of Peking man, or Sinanthropus, in a cave, and they all had a hole in them, as though cracked open to extract the brain. There was definite evidence that Peking man roasted and ate his own type. It began to look as if early man, and Peking man was nearly 400,000 years old, was not quite the holy innocent that everyone had assumed. Even before the discoveries at Chao Kaotien, scientists had heard of an even more primitive form of ape man. Blasting near Tongues in South Africa had uncovered the skull of a baby. This creature was closer to the ape than anything discovered earlier, and it apparently dated from around 800,000 years ago, twice as old as Peking man. But it was in the late 40s that the zoologist Raymond Dart came upon some of the most startling evidence concerning his South African ape man. Baboon skulls found near the site had odd depressions in the skulls. They had been killed with a weapon, the humerus, the shoulder bone of an antelope. Southern ape man, known as Australopithecus, had been a killer. He was closer to the ape than any form of primitive man. He was a kind of missing link between ape and man, and he had used weapons. Dart propounded his startling and alarming theory. Not only was early man a killer, but he had developed his brain as a result of the need to use weapons. If you're going to hit someone on the nose, you can swipe out instinctively and leave it to your muscles. But if you're going to kill an animal by hitting it on the head with a club, you need to measure carefully the distance between the end of your club and the animal's head. It requires a kind of cold concentration. It was that concentration, said Dart in his famous paper of 1949, that had started the southern ape on the long road of evolution towards modern man. And this, according to Dart, explains a great deal about the evolution of the human race. Early man grouped himself into rough tribes or communities and lived by hunting. Then someone discovered that seeds could be planted and cultivated. Man became an agriculturalist. Between 3000 and 4000 BC, he learned to sow wheat and to harvest it, and he learned the use of animals to draw his primitive plough. But as soon as settled farmers appeared, so did nomads. Man's old hunting instinct was being turned against his fellow man. Around 2000 BC came the discovery of one of the most revolutionary of war weapons, the horse. Certain tribes in Central Asia began breeding the horse, which had always been a rather small animal, hardly bigger than a large Alsatian dog, into the powerful beast that we know today. These wild men were known in the West as Scythians, and they were famous for their barbarity. Scythians learned to ride horses, and this gave them a new mobility. They could swoop on a village settlement, slaughter half the inhabitants, load up their winter grain onto spare horses, and be out of sight again in half an hour. Man, the warrior, was emerging. As the centuries went by, men developed another kind of horse, the ship, the horse of the sea. The legendary Greek Odysseus, Ulysses, who lived around 1100 BC, was a pirate who landed near lonely coastal settlements and slaughtered the natives. And by that time, piracy was already an old established trade. The Trojan War, in which Ulysses took part, was not really caused by the theft of Helen of Troy by Paris. It was an attempt by the Greeks to steal profitable trade routes from the natives of the Dardanelles. This is what war meant in the ancient world. Organised murder and robbery. There are, of course, rare exceptions. The Peloponnesian War of 431 to 404 BC was a contest between two powerful rival states, Athens and Sparta, in which the adversaries were more or less equal. This kind of war was more like the fights between animals to decide who shall be the leader of the pack. It's a contest chosen by both sides. But most war was still quite simply large-scale crime. When we read the Bible story of the fall of Jericho, in which God aided the Israelites by making the walls fall down, we tend to forget that these Israelites were basically a warlike horde who descended on a peaceful agricultural community and took it by force from its rightful owners. It was, in fact, one of the earliest war crimes. Jericho is the oldest city presently known to man, dating back as far as 8000 BC. All of this makes it clear that the concept of a war crime is highly ambiguous. Even where two neighbouring states or countries fall to quarrelling, it's very hard indeed to allot blame. For example, the increasing violence that has been going on in Northern Ireland since 1969 has its roots in the distant past. The Irish allege, with good reason, that England has been committing crimes against their country for centuries, but on closer examination, things are no longer quite so clear-cut. The English landed in Ireland in 1171, invited, oddly enough, by the Pope, and they treated the native Irish much as white Americans treated the Red Indians. So it seems to be the fault of the English. But no, for it was these same English who became Irishized, who were periodically massacred by their own countrymen in later centuries. The beginning of the present troubles can be traced back to the landing of the Spaniards and the Italians in 1580. From then on, there was a series of incidents, always described as war crimes by the other side, that kept the spirit of hatred alive. The Irish revolted against the English settlers in 1641 and murdered them by the thousand. The English sent Oliver Cromwell to take revenge. And now it becomes as difficult to discover the rights and wrongs as in any court of law. Irish school textbooks still declare that at the Siege of Drogheda in 1649, Cromwell's men slaughtered nearly 4,000 men, women and children. English historians deny this, citing Cromwell himself, who wrote at the time in a letter that only men in arms were killed. Probably we shall never know the truth. According to the English, Cromwell was avenging slaughtered Ulstermen. According to the Irish, he was intent on torture and murder, just as the Nazis were in Warsaw or in Russia. American readers, remembering the story of the brutal mass slayings of white settlers by Red Indians and Red Indians by white soldiers, will understand how difficult it is to take a simplistic view. T.S. Duke's Celebrated Criminal Cases of America, 1910, contains a hair-raising account of the outrages committed by the Sioux Indians between 1852 and 1862, with details of rapes and mutilations that would have convinced any reader that the Sioux deserved mass extermination. Nowadays, civilized opinion has swung the other way. It was the white men who were the criminals. The Indians were only trying to defend their right to live. Yet when we read Duke's account today, we're less concerned with the rights and wrongs than with the unreducible human tragedy. He writes, "The hero of the day was an 11-year-old boy named Martin Eastlick, who carried his 15-month-old brother Johnny on his back for 50 miles, but he died shortly afterwards from exposure, overexertion and lack of nourishment. Mr. Eastlick had been killed and Mrs. Eastlick was lying helpless on the ground from a bullet wound. Her two little boys, named Freddie and Frank, aged 5 and 7 respectively, were with her. Two scores saw them, and catching the children, they beat them to death with bludgeons before the helpless mother's eyes. Many other children were only beaten until they were left helpless and then left to die from hunger and exposure." 38 Indians were tried and executed for the massacres. They would have argued that it was unfair to treat the massacre as a crime, since they were at war with the white man, and the white man had treated Indian women and children just as brutally. In retrospect, we can see that it makes no difference whether it was called an act of war or a crime, for they are synonymous. As soon as we begin to discuss the rights and wrongs of such cases, we're justifying murder, as Charles Manson tried to justify his family's murder of Sharon Tate and the LaBiancas by asserting that they were at war with the pigs. The only logical course, it seems, is to recognise that murder is always unjustified, whether it is a criminal act or an act of war. It was precisely this attitude that led the Western Allies to decide to put German war criminals on trial after the Second World War, but the result demonstrated that the problem can't be solved as simply as that. There are many hidden pitfalls in the argument that war and crime should be treated as identical. In the past, it's always been taken for granted that they were two totally different things. During the Napoleonic Wars, there was a strong body of opinion in England and Prussia in favour of hanging Napoleon. But when it came to the point, sober counsels prevailed and he was sent into exile. During the First World War, there was a powerful Hang the Kaiser movement in England. But again, reason prevailed, and he was sent into exile instead. History agrees that Napoleon and the Kaiser were to blame for plunging Europe into war, but the victors chose to regard them as soldiers rather than criminals. During the Hitler War, none of the Western Allies had the least doubt that Hitler should be regarded as a criminal rather than as a military leader. The slaughter of Jews in the Warsaw Ghetto, the destruction of Lidice, the existence of Auschwitz and Buchenwald proved it beyond all doubt. When the end of the war came, Hitler and Goebbels were dead. Himmler committed suicide. Höss, the commandant of Auschwitz, was executed in Krakow. Of the men on trial at Nuremberg, very few had actually been guilty of crimes against humanity, as the indictments made clear. Göring directed the German Air Force, Dönitz the U-boats, Raeder the Navy, von Schirach led the youth movement, Speer was armaments minister, von Papen a member of the government, Ribbentrop an ambassador, Keitel a general. And Hess was not in Germany for the greater part of the war. The only defendants against whom it could be alleged that they had actually taken part in the murder of Jews were Kaltenbrunner, the Gestapo chief, Frank, administrator of Poland, and Frick. Even Stryker and Rosenberg, both rabid anti-Semites, had played no active part in the final solution. It is to the credit of the court that von Papen, Schacht and Fritschter, the head of the radio division, were found not guilty, but heavily to its discredit that men like Dönitz, Raeder and Speer were found guilty. If Germany had won the war, then most British and American generals and admirals could have been found guilty on the same grounds. The Western Allies regarded Nuremberg as the noble administration of justice. Historians of the future will probably regard it as a legal farce. This leaves the interesting problem, what should have been done with Hitler, Himmler and men like Höss if they had been taken alive? The simple answer is that the victors in any war have the right, if they choose, to kill their enemies to prevent them from doing further mischief. After all, Napoleon escaped from Elba and forced the British and the Prussians to fight him again at Waterloo. If Hitler had been shot, it would have seemed a comparatively clean and honest solution. It's difficult to apply either adjective to the Nuremberg trials. Perhaps the case that argues most strongly for a legal definition of war crime is the notorious murder of Polish officers at Katyn Wood. Stalin launched an attack on Poland 2 weeks after Hitler's troops swept towards Warsaw. Stalin's excuse later was that he had to stop Germany from taking all of Poland. 200,000 Polish prisoners were deported to Russia. When Hitler invaded Russia in 1941, Stalin joined the Western Allies, and since Poland already had a government in exile in London, the question of releasing Polish prisoners arose. Vast numbers of captured men proved to be missing, notably around 4,000 of Poland's top army officers. At this point, the Germans embarrassed their former allies by asserting in a broadcast that the Russians had deliberately massacred 10,000 Poles at Katyn Wood near Smolensk. The German troops had found the mass grave when they captured Smolensk in July of 1941. The Russians immediately countered by declaring that if there was a mass grave, then the Germans were responsible. The discovery that the 4,143 bodies in the mass grave had been killed by German bullets seemed to lend colour to this accusation, until the Germans pointed out that the works at Gönschau had supplied quantities of ammunition to Russia. Investigations that have continued for years since the end of the war suggest definitely that it was the Russians who had taken this opportunity to dispose of most of the officer corps of their old hereditary enemy, the Poles. A British television documentary on the murders in 1971 included survivors who were quite positive about the Russian responsibility. There were strong attempts by the Russian embassy to prevent the programme from being shown. There can be no doubt that, according to the Geneva and Hague conventions, the murder of war prisoners is a crime. On the other hand, Soviet communists always insisted that they make their own rules. A glance at the long article on the laws of war in the Encyclopaedia Britannica reveals that moralists and philosophers have been arguing about them ever since the days of ancient Rome, and that there has never been any general agreement. It seems safe to say that the Katyn Wood murders, like the Nuremberg trials, will remain a matter for moral and legal controversy for centuries. As to the basic question of whether man is a killer by deep instinct, there's now a powerful body of opinion in opposition to Dart's fatalism. The psychologist Abraham Maslow, speaking of Freud's theories of sex and aggression, said emphatically that Freud had sold human nature short, and an increasing number of psychologists would now agree with Maslow that man has higher as well as lower needs, and that these higher needs are just as instinctive as the basic needs for territory, food and sex. It may be true that man has evolved from a killer ape, but he has shed other simian habits, such as the tail and a preference for walking on all fours. Science teaches us that it's sensible to learn from the past, but it's dangerous as well as stupid to assume that the future is rigidly conditioned by the past.